At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For sale and really cheap, too. U.S. government debt. The United States is getting deeper in the hole every day, but even low interest rates on $1 trillion, boy, that can really add up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 23rd of November. Good to have you here. The Treasury Department put hat firmly in hand today. The government went back to the marketplace looking for buyers. $118 billion worth of Treasury notes, bills, and bonds will be on sale this week. Washington's trying to finance its spending habits, obviously, or our spending habits, truth be told. As annual deficits move into the trillions of dollars, there is increasing concern about how much the government owes and about how much that debt costs. And yet, Washington keeps on borrowing. When we get stories like these, we turn to our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
One-word question here, Bob. Why?
Well, two-word response. It depends. We still keep pouring a lot of money on trying to smother the financial crisis fire, if you will. Okay, so a lot of this is stimulus spending. A lot of it is giving money to the banks so they can lend. We've heard that time and time again. But there are a lot of groups who say that a big part of this spending is stuff that isn't necessary. It's just Washington addicted to its usual ways. And leaders of both political parties, and really on all sides of the political spectrum, say we really do need to get a handle on this.
What happens, though, if we don't?
Well, there's concern that just servicing this debt, and that is just the interest charges on all of this debt, could amount to as much as $700 billion just in interest charges by 2019, which isn't too far away. I spoke to J.D. Foster. He's a budget forecasting expert at the Heritage Foundation, and he sees a real crisis looming if the government doesn't back off and soon.
When financial markets realize that the federal government has no intent on changing course, then the markets will say, whoa, just as any lender would do to a borrower, when you realize the borrower tends to be grossly irresponsible. When that happens, the lender says no more. And in this case, the markets will express that by a very large increase in interest rates across the board.
Let me ask you this interest rate question, though, because we talked about this on the broadcast on Friday. Investors have so much spare cash that they are plowing money into short-term treasury bills, right? They were sending the yield negative on that.
That's right.
Paying
That's
the government to hold their money on Friday. How does that play into this entire debt equation that the government has?
Yeah, so if they're so worried about it, why would they be plowing all their money into these treasury notes? Well, there is a school of thought that banks right now, because we're coming to the end of the year, are trying to put their money in places where it's a lot safer, in less risky areas, also a lot more liquid, that they can get to it quickly should something go wrong. And so they want liquid cash, and T-bills are the best place to do that.
Back to the spending part of this for a second, Bob. You know, you hear a lot of people out there saying, wait a minute, the economy is still really tender. What we need is more government spending, not worries about interest rate on government debt as a percentage of GDP and all these kinds of things. What do you say to that?
Well, as I mentioned, there are people out there who say, look, just put the brakes on this right now, that it's not helping the economy, that it's damaging the economy. But there are others, fair enough, who say we need to at least have this stimulus money in the system. We need to keep spending in that way. And even there, critics say, okay, if you need the stimulus spending, at least separate that out from other things, such as healthcare reform, for example, things that they say aren't necessary to improve the economy at this point.
Yeah, the point being that we're just commingling all this borrowing that we're doing and nobody really knows what's going on.
That everybody's just spending for the sake of spending.
And in the meanwhile, Treasury Department says these bond sales are going to continue.
That's right. Treasury just served notice on the bond market earlier this month that we can expect another year of bond sales at about these levels, which would mean as much as $2 trillion sold in the coming year, the government going even $2 trillion more into debt. In the past year, we sold $1.9 trillion. We are just going deeper and deeper into debt every single day.
Marketplace's senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
If you want to get some idea of how deep in the hole Uncle Sam is, all you have to do is Google the phrase debt clock. That'll get you some really interesting links. But if you have used the new search engine from Microsoft, Bing, you know it has something that Google doesn't have. Really pretty pictures on its homepage. But Bing may soon have something else that Google doesn't, something a good deal more valuable, too. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and some other content that is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. There are reports today that Microsoft is trying to do a deal with News Corp, nothing merger or acquisition-like, but quite possibly bigger. Microsoft would pay News Corp to keep its content on Bing and off Google. Joel Rose reports now on the latest round in the never-ending search wars.
Rupert Murdoch has made no secret of his disdain for Google and other search engines that link to content for free. Here's how he described them earlier this month in an interview with Sky News Australia, part of his vast media empire.
The people who just simply pick up everything and run with it and steal our stories. We say they steal our stories, they just take them.
Now Murdoch may take them back. News Corp is reportedly in talks to give Bing exclusive access to its content for a price and delist that content from Google. Forrester research analyst Shar Van Boskirk says the deal could be a coup for Microsoft.
A way to kind of show that they're serious about search, a way to steal some momentum from Google, and a way to drive traffic to Bing.com.
Neither company would comment on the reports, but critics think such a deal could hurt News Corp more than it hurts Google. Sure, News Corp might collect a hefty fee from Microsoft, but News Corp's websites would lose the traffic they get from Google. Here's Google spokesman Gabriel Stricker.
The value that we view ourselves providing to news publishers is basically the traffic that we send from Google News and web search to them on the order of about 100,000 clicks every minute.
Those clicks translate into millions of dollars in advertising revenue for News Corp and millions in search revenue for Google. It seems that Rupert Murdoch may be willing to accept less traffic to keep Google from making money off his content for free. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
We are, as of this Monday, just 4 short days away from Black Friday, that once-a-year, day-after-Thanksgiving spectacle where the American consumer really gets down to it. This year, though, like never before, retailers are fighting to position themselves as your allies in saving money. Few national chains have been at that game longer than Walmart has. And Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the world's biggest retailer is now claiming to save consumers cash even if they don't shop there.
If you watch TV, you've probably seen this ad.
The family budget. In today's economy, nobody's more committed to helping family budgets go further than Walmart. Walmart saves the average family about $3,100 a year, no matter where they shop.
What? Okay, how can Walmart save you money if you don't shop there? Well, they say other stores cut their prices to compete.
The overall level of consumer prices are lower, essentially, anywhere you shop.
Chris Hollings is at IHS Global Insight.
So you do not actually have to shop at Walmart to get these savings.
Hollings led the research Walmart uses in this ad. He says by tracking Walmart's expansion, his team was able to isolate an economic Walmart effect. Today, he says prices for retail goods are 3.6% lower across the board because of the chain. But to save more than $3,000 a year, a, quote, average family would have to spend more than $83,000 shopping.
This headline number is technically accurate, but misleading.
Charles Fishman is author of the book, The Walmart Effect. He points out that the median household income is less than $51,000.
A family earning $51,000 a year saves about $640 a year compared to what they would otherwise have had to spend.
That's a far cry from Walmart's claim, but
$640 for a typical family still adds up to a TV, a big screen TV that you wouldn't otherwise get to buy, or 2 weeks at camp for a kid who wouldn't otherwise get to go to camp. And so that's not trivial. It's a question of keeping it in perspective.
And it's a benefit consumers get whether they shop at Walmart or not. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn. for Marketplace.
You need look no further than today's report on used homes to have a really good picture of how government incentives can change consumer behavior. We learned this morning that October sales of existing homes rose more than 10% from September's report. 10%. Anybody remember that $8,000 homebuyer tax credit that was supposed to expire at the end of this month? Anybody think that had anything to do with it? Wall Street sure did. Traders rode the housing industry to a boffo day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Northern England had some serious flooding at the end of last week. The deluge was said to have been the worst to hit the area in 1,000 years. Hundreds of homes and businesses were destroyed. Police and the British Army are out in force today checking the safety of 1,800 bridges. And insurance companies are adding up the damage. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
After rescuing them from their homes last week, today the police allowed hundreds of residents back into the devastated Cumbrian town of Cockermouth.
Don't all rush, because we've still got people unaccounted for that we want to make sure everybody's safe. So let's. Just
4 days after the flood, triggered by the heaviest rainfall on record, the residents have seen for themselves the extent of the damage. Furniture smashed, shop fronts ripped out and trashed, businesses ruined, as Catherine Hetherington, who runs a bookshop in the town, told the BBC.
I'm devastated, but we expected it to be bad, and it is bad. Yeah, we've lost all the stock downstairs. Yeah, it's all got to be thrown away because it's all water damaged or, you know, anything else.
Across Cumbria, 1,300 homes and shops were flooded. 6 river bridges collapsed. With a general election due next year, political leaders were quickly on the scene. Prime Minister Gordon Brown later promised to pump in extra cash.
And I can say this morning that additional emergency funding will be made available to support the necessary repair work for bridges and roads.
That work will likely cost up to $200 million. Insurance companies reckon they'll pay out a similar sum to households and businesses. But that's nothing. 2 years ago, floods across a wider swathe of Britain cost insurers $4.5 billion. A pattern is developing, says Phil Rothwell of the government's Environment Agency.
The last few years have seen clearly a lot of major events and coming thick and fast. And certainly that's in line with what climate change scientists are telling us.
His agency now spends $1.3 billion a year beefing up Britain's flood defences. He wants even more to keep pace with the impact of climate change. In spite of the UK's budget deficit, he's confident after the latest deluge, he'll get the money. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Absolutely nobody is surprised the teen vampire movie New Moon had a healthy showing this weekend, more than $140 million in box office receipts. Not a whole lot of films bring in that kind of cash these days, even on opening weekend, because Hollywood is going through some of the same pains the rest of the economy is. Movie moguls increasingly have to take their grand visions with a dose of reality, but that's going to be tough because commentator and Hollywood writer Rob Long says scaling back is much harder than dreaming big when you work in the business.
The last time I went to New York, I got off the plane, I headed to the cab line, and I thought, wait a minute, that cab is going to run me about $60. So, overcome with a sudden attack of parsimony, I took the train. I bought a Metro card, the whole thing. And when I checked into my hotel, they asked, do you need any help with your bags, sir? And I said, no. No, I don't need any help with my bags. A few years ago, sure, when I was in year 14 of a lucrative studio deal, I mean, I would have pulled up here in a town car and let someone else carry my bag. But these days, I'm trying to live a little simpler, trying to spend my money smarter on things I really cherish, like far-off travel and great bottles of wine and a greater sense of freedom, I said. In my mind, I said that in my mind. In real life, I just sort of grunted and held up my small bag, and then a guy came and took it. If I ever get one of those fat money jobs again, a friend of mine told me recently, I will do it totally differently. I will respect money. Now, he was a producer at a major film studio for years. He made a lot of big budget pictures. But, you know, a bunch of nice cars, a house on Kona, it all adds up to a pretty hot cash bonfire every month, which is okay until, well, until now. Now, the irony, of course, is that a lot of people like that are out of the business now. They're teaching in a local community college somewhere or running a muffin store in a resort town. And that's really too bad, because those are the people we really need right now. People who've learned the hard way how to do stuff cheaper and smaller and faster. So the night I got into New York, I had dinner with some friends. You took the subway? They asked. Really? Is your career in trouble? No, I said. No, I just realized that I used to spend a lot of money on stupid stuff, on help I didn't need and luxuries I didn't really appreciate. So my new goal is to be less helpless, less wasteful, I said. In my mind, I said that in my mind. In real life, I told them that it had nothing to do with money, that I was just trying to be more green. Which, thank God, they bought.
Rob Long is a writer in Hollywood and a frequent contributor to KCRW. Tell us how you've cut back in your life. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, when Asian doesn't really tell you all that much.
Do we mean Indian? Do we mean Cambodian, Korean, Chinese, Pakistani, and the list goes on.
Health and identity, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials packed on 132 points today, nearly 1.3%, ended at 10,450. The NASDAQ gained 29 points, 1.4%, finished at 2176. The S&P 500 padded up 14 points. 1.3% wound up at 1106. Homebuilders reconstructed. D.R. Horton added 2.8%. MDC Holdings stacked on 1%. The sliding dollar helped commodity prices like gold. That rose to a seventh straight high. Newmont Mining buffed up 2% today. LDK Solar beamed up almost 7%. The Chinese maker of solar wafers and modules reported a surprise third quarter profit. Deere bulldozed up 2%. Morgan Stanley upgraded the machinery maker. The price on the 10-year T-note rose. That pushed the yield down to 3.35%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
Marketplace State Book. Here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the second estimate gross domestic product report for the third quarter. As we gear up for the holiday shopping season, U.S. PIRG releases its traditional Trouble in Toyland report to help parents shop for safe gifts. And it's the 150th anniversary of On the Origin of Species. Charles Darwin's book was first published on November 24, 1859. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you were a teenager in the early 1980s, and this is probably more true of men than it is of women, chances are you spent a lot of time in the arcade becoming familiar with the sound of this. Pinball machines. Used to be, they were everywhere. Arcades, movie theaters, bars, but really not so much anymore. Because it turns out that what made the machine such a hit at one point is actually what did them in. Jeff Ely is a professor of economics at Northwestern University. He wrote about the economics of pinball the other day on his blog, Cheap Talk. So we called him up. Jeff, good to have you here.
Hi.
I have to tell you, I read a fair number of economics blogs, but this is the first one I've seen posting about the economics of pinball. Where did this come from?
Well, I was a pinball player in high school. at some point I noticed that Pinball had disappeared, and I had questions about why, ideas about why. I sort of used my training as an economist to think about what were the reasons, and it just as a miracle, the other day I was at a party and I met this guy who was involved in the design of all of these classic pinball machines, and the moment I found that out, I just unleashed all of these economist questions to him to find out what was going on in their head. And it turns out exactly what was going on in my head was going on in theirs, too.
In this post that you wrote about this, you actually point out two games, a game called Black Knight and then something called High Speed, that are pivotal moments in the history of the decline and fall of pinball. Explain.
Okay, so I was 12 when Black Knight appeared.
In 1980, right?
Okay, so, you know, what I can tell you my memory of Black Knight was that I was at a mall, and I saw these old-style Fenway Park scoreboard, analog buzzing and beeping pinball machines pushed to the side to make way for this gleaming thing called Black Knight that had this digital voice saying, "Will you play the Black Knight?" And it had, you know, multi-ball features and multimedia and all of this. And, you know, I was only 12, so I couldn't play the game for very long, but it was hard. It basically changed the economics of pinball because now with the digital features, you could program the high score threshold, you know, what you needed to get a free game, fly. Okay, so you could figure out how many people were playing the game, what their scores were, what the average score was. You could act like, you know, a textbook monopolist plotting a demand curve using sort of on-the-fly data generated by these pinball players and figure out what was the high score that would maximize whatever, you know, how many people were plunking quarters into the machine.
So this machine was adaptive, right? It changed score based on who was playing and their skill levels.
Exactly. Now, the other thing that they did, which was really cute, is, you know, there was this old thing called Match. Okay, so for these analog pinball machines, there was this little thing that spun around, and if it matched the last two digits of your score, you got a free game.
Yeah.
Now, with the digital scoring, you know, the computer basically just picked it in funny ways to try to get people to play when it needed people to play and not to play when it didn't. So, for example, if you and your girlfriend had just played a game, you put two quarters in the machine, and neither of you got a free game, it would very often give one of you a match so that the other would put another quarter in and keep you playing. You know, there was kind of some basic price theory at work here and then pure behavioral economics behind the match.
And then a couple of years later, this thing called High Speed. Where did that come in?
Okay, so High Speed was kind of the next generation taking advantage of these digital features. It was at that point that the game was really, really advanced to the point where beginning pinball players were really discouraged from playing if they didn't have those skills that they had learned on these gateway machines like Black Knight.
Does this apply with other video games like, I don't know, like Pac-Man as an arcade game? I mean, did they do the same thing?
Video games are purely digital, so you could change the level of difficulty on the fly as a player was playing. So you had very easy levels that drew in the easy players, and then the level of difficulty increased. Pinball, you know, once you design the machine, it's designed. You can't change it in the play of a given player. And so you either had to target the hardcore players or the beginners. And they took the hardcore route, and that was great for pinball early on, and it eventually spelled its demise.
Jeff Ely, he teaches economics at Northwestern University. He blogs at a blog called Cheap Talk. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Over the weekend, the Senate decided it's in fact okay to have a debate about health care reform. It will start in earnest when Congress reconvenes next Monday. But a lot of the discussion so far has been about changing health insurance, not necessarily changing health care. Over the years, several studies have shown that minorities tend to receive lower quality care than whites do. That not only increases illnesses, it also drives up the overall cost of health care. So the Institute of Medicine has issued some recommendations designed to close that quality gap. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
We're all familiar with the medical forms you fill out at the doctor's office or when you go to the hospital. Among the questions about allergies and family history, there are usually a few about race, ethnicity, and language. Too few, say medical researchers, and the questions don't go far enough. Ramana Hasnain-Winia directs the Center for Healthcare Equity at Northwestern School of Medicine. She says general labels like Hispanic are just a starting point.
We have gone one step beyond that and also recommended that granular ethnicity be collected as well.
What she means is that healthcare providers need to go beyond Hispanic. They should know whether your ancestors came from Mexico or Cuba or both. Sarah Rosenbaum is a professor of law and health policy at George Washington University. She says the more information healthcare providers have on patients' backgrounds, the easier it is to evaluate how different groups fare when they seek healthcare.
Not in ways that name the patients or name the doctors, but that allow us to see patterns in communities and in healthcare systems.
So healthcare workers can use that information to see that everyone gets equal care. More data can also lead to better preventive care. That could save billions each year in medical costs. Ramana Hasnain-Winia says going beyond a broad term like Asian can reveal critical information.
Do we mean Indian? Do we mean Cambodian, Korean, Chinese, Pakistani, and the list goes on.
For example, she says Korean-American women are less likely than other Asian groups to get mammograms. That kind of information could lead to more outreach in Korean communities. And Cambodian women are far less likely to breastfeed than other new mothers in American hospitals. Cambodian tradition says new mothers should eat specific hot foods after the baby's born. American hospital food doesn't fit the bill. So many Cambodian women don't breastfeed. In one study, hospital staff devised a new Cambodian menu. Breastfeeding tripled. Language can also be a big barrier to getting proper care. A 2006 study of medical errors found the majority had to do with communication problems. Medical errors can cost more than $50 billion a year. Ambulances back in and out of the parking area outside the emergency room at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. An elderly lady is wheeled in with an injured leg. Her first language is Spanish. She's in a lot of pain. Many of the staff at Montefiore speak Spanish. That makes it more likely that when the woman is released, she'll understand what she needs to do. Dr. Rohit Bala is chief quality officer at Montefiore. He says hospitals are trying to cut readmission rates, which drive up expenses and can lead to further illnesses. To do that, he says, you need to study who's being readmitted. Montefiore is doing just that.
What is our readmission rate for the population, let's say, who speaks Spanish versus that who speaks English? Because you're trying to get people to take their medications, follow dietary advice, keep their follow-up appointments.
All that involves making yourself understood. Advocates say if all healthcare providers carried out these kinds of studies and knew their patients better, the quality gap in healthcare would shrink, and so would spending. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, you remember back when the recession was just getting going and people high up in the Bush administration, including the president, kept saying the fundamentals of the economy are sound? And you remember all the criticism they got for that? After a cabinet meeting this afternoon, a large part of which was spent talking about the economy, President Obama said this. He said that the economy has, quote, core strengths that's going to put the U.S. in a good position over the long run. You heard it here first, everybody, on a program called Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 132 points. That is 1.3%. The Nasdaq hiked up 29 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 packed on 14 points, 1.3%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the latest business and economic news. And tomorrow afternoon on this broadcast, it is the thought that counts, but how much is that thought worth?
The answer I've come to is that people value stuff they receive as gifts 20% less per dollar spent than stuff they buy for themselves.
Oh, man. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.